The content in this program is for informational purposes only. You should not construe any information or other material as investment, financial, tax, or other advice. The views expressed by the participants are solely their own. A participant may have taken or recommended any investment position discussed, but may close such position or alter its recommendation at any time without notice. Nothing contained in this program constitutes a solicitation, recommendation, endorsement, or offer to buy or sell any securities or other financial instruments in any jurisdiction. Please consult your own investment or financial advisor for advice related to all investment decisions. Don't forget to follow at Lead Lag Report on Twitter to join these conversations live. And check out the Lead Lag Report at www.leadlagreport.com. Use promo code PODCAST30 for 2 weeks free and 30% off to get access to award-winning research and anticipate stock market crashes, corrections, and bear markets. And now, on to our Lead Lag Live discussion hosted by Michael Guyon.
I've now got around 10,000 subscribers, getting some good momentum there. Any kind of help in spreading the word would be much appreciated. With that said, my name is Michael Guyon, publisher of the Lead Lag Report. Joining us for the hour here is Rick Rule, a man who needs no introduction. But for those who are not familiar, Rick, with your background, for those that do need the introduction, let's do a little origin story on who you are, how'd you get involved in markets, your journey through Sprott, and what you're doing now.
I'm a 69-year-old, allegedly retired investor and speculator. I came into financial markets at the ripe old age of 20 while I was a student at the University of British Columbia. I need to say I'm American, not Canadian, but I did go to school in Canada. So I've been in financial markets around natural resources and later around conventional financial services for now 49 years. I built several financial services businesses around natural resources over that 49-year period and sold two of them, Quest Capital and Global Resource Investments, to Sprott Inc., which is a Canadian-domiciled asset manager that trades on the New York Stock Exchange under the symbol SII. I'm formally retired from Sprott, although I remain their largest shareholder and I remain on the board of directors. My activities now include managing a couple of private investment partnerships in runoff, running a business called Rule Investment Media, which I have absolutely no idea how I'm going to monetize, and being part of starting the seventh bank of my career, Battle Bank, which is the successor to a previous successful bank startup that we did in 1999. Which was called Everbank, one of the first successful online banks in the U.S.
You mentioned that you're allegedly retired, which I think is amusing because I think when you're a successful entrepreneur, you never really stop building. Talk about what it is that keeps you motivated because you've done it all, you've seen it all, but you're still, as you mentioned, at your age, doing new things and starting up new ventures.
Well, I have a lovely retirement, actually. When I decided to retire, I experienced a lot of trauma because it was pretty clear to me that business and the process of starting businesses and serving markets was important to my sense of self-image. And it was simply the most interesting use of time that I had. So what I determined is that retirement for me would mean that I would do as little as I could that annoyed me and as much as I could that gave me pleasure. So as an example, as a sort of a committed libertarian, I have problems with various elements of the regulatory environment. So I've given up my securities licenses and anything that might cause me to come into contact, unnecessary contact with the SEC or FINRA. I also, although allegedly I can do it, don't enjoy many administrative tasks. I went from having, sort of ultimately 220 line employees that reported to me to having one employee and I report to her. So retirement for me means I'm doing more of what I enjoy and less of what I don't enjoy. Building businesses, or more now in my declining years, helping committed entrepreneurs build businesses is what I love doing.
That self-image point reminds me of, I just recently saw Top Gun 2, which was actually absolutely incredible. But there's a line that Tom Cruise puts in, something along the lines of, being a pilot is not what I do, it's who I am.
Right.
Just like being somebody who's in the field, who's the man in the arena, It's not what you do in the fight to try to build a business in the investment industry. It's who you are as an individual. And I think that I would argue is what separates those who stick to the business side of investing longer term. You almost have to have a real personality for it.
It's funny you say that. I conducted an interview yesterday in conjunction with our upcoming Natural Resources Investment Symposium, where I had the ability to convene a panel of five different entrepreneurs who had built mostly several multi-billion dollar natural resource businesses from standing starts over their career. All of them are in their late 60s or early 70s, and all of them are currently extraordinarily active, not because they need the money, because, as you suggest, building natural resource-based businesses is who they are. So I think you're exactly correct.
So it's interesting because I would argue we went from a pendulum swing where there was this commodity super cycle to then, you know, which you can argue is an analog cycle, to then maybe a digital super cycle, which is where we got to with cryptocurrencies. So from analog scarcity to digital scarcity. And now we're kind of going back to the analog commodity scarcity being at the forefront of people's minds. And I've had a lot of different thought leaders, including some from your own stomping ground, like Kevin Bambro and others, who have talked about this kind of structural underinvestment that's taken place in the natural resource space. Lay out for the audience here a little bit why there's been an underinvestment in commodities, in natural resources, and who you think might be to blame for maybe not encouraging it.
Well, I think that one reason for the underinvestment was two decades of overinvestment in the 1970s and the 1980s. We had an enormously successful episode for two decades where capital was easy to find, where capital was easy to deploy, and the exploration results that we got as a consequence of that exploration boom were fantastic. Major, major, major new oil fields were discovered. The entire Nevada gold mining complex, as an example, came into being. So there was structural underinvestment in natural resources for two decades as an echo of the overinvestment that had occurred in the decade of the 70s and 80s.
Is that overinvestment because of the supply shock?
It's a function of underinvestment, again, in a period that occurred in the 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s. These things are extremely cyclical. Beginning sort of 1982, I guess, real net investment in natural resources went negative, which is to say that the industry was generating substantially more cash than it was consuming. And there were other sectors of the economy that appeared to be and probably were more attractive than natural resources. And so capital was diverted from natural resources because the capital actually on a current basis wasn't needed. The industry perhaps didn't forget, but the markets forgot that lack of new project investment and sustaining capital investment in an industry where your basic asset depletes is a necessity to maintain the industry. You know, every day that you pump an oil field, your business gets smaller. You can't stand at the top of a wellbore and pour in water and fertilizer and have it make more oil. You know, you got to go find the stuff, you got to permit the stuff, and all that stuff happened with less frequency beginning in the early part of the decade of the 90s. We had a couple of structural rebounds in the natural resource-based businesses, the most dramatic being 2000 to 2011. And what we saw is levels of investment for a 6 or 7 year period go to sort of 300% of norm. But if you look at any decade, in the decade 1980, 1990, 2000 to 2010, 2010 to 2020, if you look at any decade, you will see that as a society, we have underinvested in the broad range of extractive industries fairly substantially. The consequence of that now is that in terms of the developed resource base that humankind exists on, things like the Cantarell field in Mexico, the Ghawar field in Saudi Arabia, the great copper mines of the world, be they Chuquicamata or Bingham Canyon. The truth is that we are living on reasonably priced commodities that are the consequence of exploration and production efforts that took place 50 and 100 years ago. And what most consumers don't see is the fact that we have a fairly precipitous cliff that we're coming to that is a consequence of really decades of underinvestment. The second thing, I guess, is that extractive industries aren't pretty. They aren't politically correct. It is possible to conduct natural resource exploitation activities in ways that are minimally harming if you define harm as the export of deleterious materials from a mine site or a well site. But you're frankly never going to make an oil field or a refinery or a pipeline or a strip mine pretty. And to the extent that popular attention for investment and for career is determined more by popular narrative, it's likely that the natural resource businesses will be out of favor forever.
So, okay, so there's a lot to branches to go off of that. And I was taking notes as you're talking here. So you mentioned commodities, and we know this. They're extremely cyclical. You'll have these 7 years of famine followed by 7 years of feast sort of equivalents in the way that these commodity moves happen broadly. But I'm curious if you think that the duration of cycles may have shortened up in the most recent, you know, period. And I say that only because presumably technology makes things happen faster. Presumably with globalization, we can talk about the deglobalization move, but globalization means you have potentially more players to suddenly turn up and extract raw materials. How do you think about the duration with which commodities could lead here? How do you think investors should be thinking about that?
I think the duration of favor and attention is much quicker. The distribution of information and paradigm and narrative through social media has revolutionized the way people think. 20 years ago, people got their information, they got their paradigm about investments and everything else from academia, from, you know, the sort of corporate establishment, and from the political establishment. Now there's folks like you, and people get their information, they get their paradigm from each other, which means I think that the popularity of various narratives ebbs and flows with much more rapidity than it did in the past. I think, too, that the advances that you describe in technology are beginning to affect some change in the exploration business, in the exploration part of the business, particularly in oil and gas exploration, where the business is large enough that the leverage impact of increased technology is important, less so in mining. But the truth is that these are very long lead time businesses. I'll give you one example, the Resolution Copper Deposit, which is a world scale copper deposit in Arizona, a billion tons plus of reserves, average grade 1.5% copper. That's three times the average worldwide extracted grade. Truly a gem. That was discovered 25 years ago. They have been in the exploration and the permitting phase now for 20 years, really with no end in sight. If they obtain regulatory concurrence that they can go ahead, then they will need to finance the mine build, which will be $6 or $7 billion. Then they will need to construct the mine and attendant facilities, which will take 6 or 7 years, which is to say, from the point in time that the need for more copper is identified until the point in time where new mine construction can impact supply, can easily be 20 years, even after the deposit has been discovered. The discovery process, in my mind, for a tier one deposit, which is to say a world scale deposit, is about 10 years from the time that the potential of the district is identified through a series of theses around exploration and a series of methods to test the thesis. That is to say, in my experience, from the sort of conception of a deposit until the deposit has been framed in, when it's successful, requires 10 to 12 years. So if you look at a 10 to 12 year exploration cycle and you put on top of that 20 year permitting and development cycle, what you learn is that from the time the need for copper is recognized until the time when society has invested sufficient treasure in increasing production can easily be 3 decades. And until, in fact, unless we begin to develop a political consensus around the fact that our material well-being is important, I think those lead times will only grow.
And what's interesting about that is in the context, going back to social media, in a world where people's attention spans are getting
shorter, it's hard for people to think in time frames like that, right? Because we want the immediacy of something working today or tomorrow, not, you know, many, many years from now. And I think that becomes perhaps what amplifies these maybe strong moves up or down in commodities and in the underlying equities, in the sense that there's a longer term investment thesis, but people think the investment thesis plays out immediately, and that creates dislocations in price.
I think that's right. Now, I do believe that social media ultimately will react to markets, which is to say that in an audience as broad as the social media market, which is to say all of humankind, that there will be subsets, and maybe fairly large subsets, that have a much more rational view of how human affairs ought to be conducted. So I guess in one sense, social media as it exists reflects what people wish were true. But I think social media has the ability to segregate audiences into those who care about what is true, too. I said at the onset of this interview, that's one of the interesting things that happens is that social media disintermediates access to information and access to audiences in ways where, as an example, an old retired speculator, libertarian like me, can build an 80,000 person audience at ruleinvestmentmedia.com. I would not have had access to an audience that size 20 years ago had I chosen to distribute information through, as an example, the university system or Dow Jones. But the fact is now, through channels like yours and my own, I can talk direct. And I think that that does have the capacity to develop large enough audiences that there is a consensus for some type of positive change.
All right. So we talked about this underinvestment point and the time lag. And one can argue that you can see what is most underinvested based on prices today. But again, we go back to this idea that there's overreactions constantly. From your knowledge of various commodities, looking at where supply is and where demand is likely to keep accelerating, I'm curious, Rick, what are some of the areas within the commodity space that you think has the most disconnect relative to where demand is ultimately going against supply today, and then what will be coming in the future?
The most investable, the second most obvious, but the most investable is uranium. In terms of playing the cyclical contrarian game in resources, what you look for is fairly perverse. You look for an industry that's in effect in liquidation, where the product that industry produces is essential for the material progress of humankind. Uranium is all about electricity. And demand for electricity, both in developed markets like the ones that we inhabit, but particularly in undeveloped markets, continues to grow. Meanwhile, the price of uranium for some years languished below $20 a pound. In an industry where the fully loaded cost to develop a pound of uranium, I'm not talking about the mined cost, but the total cost, the finding cost, the G&A, the cost of capital, the social rents, taxes, royalties, stuff like that, was about $60 a pound. So the industry was making the stuff for $60 a pound. They were selling it for $20 a pound, losing $40 a pound, and doing that 85 million times a year. You know, it got rather boring. Now, by the way, 120 million pounds a year. The uranium price now has scaled up to $50 a pound, which is to say the industry now only loses $10 a pound. But losing $10 million a pound, now 120 million times a year, is still a fairly boring activity. With regards to uranium, despite the fact that when people think about it, they don't think about their lights going on. They think about Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The public perception around uranium is horrific. But uranium is the best source of non-carbon generating baseload power in the world. The truth is that even in markets that believe that they can afford not to have nuclear power, I'm talking about the United States, Germany, Japan, places like that, if the price of uranium doesn't go up in the next 5 or 6 years, the lights go out. In the United States itself, 20% of baseload power is generated by nuclear power. And you can't have a circumstance where that commodity becomes unavailable and our system functions too simultaneously. So uranium is the most obvious example. Right now, on a global basis, we use 200 million pounds a year because we had a historic oversupply after Fukushima knocked Japanese demand offline. So we use 200 million pounds and we make 120 million pounds. We have an 80 million pound a year supply deficit. When that goes away, we have a real, real, real problem. We have a problem that's exacerbated because the existing market structure means that existing production has a fully loaded cost of $60 per pound. But in order to bring new production online, in order to, you know, go through the exploration cycle, the capital cycle, the inflation that is incipient in the supply chains and natural resources, I think the incentive price for new production is about $75 a pound. So the only way that we have to eliminate the supply gap, the difference between 120 million pounds supplied and 200 million pounds demanded, is to take the uranium price from its current level of about $50 a pound up through $75 a pound. That one's a no-brainer. It isn't going to happen right away. It might take 2 years. It might take 3 years. It might take 5 years. If we have a recession in the interim, which reduces electricity demand worldwide, it might be postponed beyond that. But the truth is, with regards to uranium, the answer begins with when, not if. It's going to happen. The question is how it happens. The second opportunity that I'd like to draw your listeners' attention to is more interesting than relevant in the sense that the most mispriced natural resource that I know of in the world is water. And that's more problematic because there's structural difficulties in the water market. Water is regarded as a human right, and it's been subsidized politically for a very long time. We joke in the water business that water naturally flows downhill to money, which is to say, in a free market, there would be an auction of water. And if water was more valuable for brushing teeth and flushing toilets, then urban users would prevail. If water was more valuable for watering golf courses, then recreational users would prevail. If water was more valuable for growing crops, then agricultural users would prevail. And you would have rations set by utility and price. But that's not what happens in water. It doesn't flow downhill to utility. It flows uphill to votes. Water is aggregated and distributed politically. The consequence of that is that people have voted to underinvest in water and subsidize their own uses for a very long time. That itself is exacerbated by the political process, which is to say that water revenues often flow to political entities who take the money, as an example, from a municipal water utility into general revenues and use that money to conduct politically popular spending programs. It might be educational programs. It might be parks, to the detriment of reinvesting in the water infrastructure, which means in the United States, as an example, that it's estimated that more than 25% of the water that enters into municipal systems isn't delivered to the tap. It's wasted. So the biggest upside I see in a commodity is water. But I don't see how we get there from here. I don't see how the political consensus develops to allocate water rationally rather than politically. There are so many distortions in the market. And the investment mechanisms are really archaic, I guess, because of too much government participation. As an example, 30 years ago, there was a relatively active water rights market, and I was very active in it myself. Those water rights now have largely been purchased in states where they can, states like California and Texas. So the joke around water is, although it's probably the best commodity speculation in the history of the country, the joke goes that sadly, water investments are illiquid.
We'll be back after a quick break.
Hello, listeners. Michael Guyatt here from Lead Lag Live. Are you ready to take a deep dive into market trends, risk management, and investment strategies? Then you need the Lead Lag Report. Our in-depth analysis helps you understand the financial markets like never before. And guess what? We're giving you a chance to experience it at a discounted rate. Visit theleadlag.report/leadlaglive and get an exclusive 30% off on your subscription. Don't miss out. Level up your investment game with the Lead Lag Report. And now, back to our discussion.
Yeah, no, that there's certainly an irony to the way that's framed. Let's go back to uranium for a second, because it takes me back again to the space I did with Kevin Bambro. And he had made the point that And I presume you would agree, Rick, that if this kind of trend towards electric vehicles is unstoppable, that the way to really play that trend is not necessarily through a Tesla, but through uranium to power the grid to ultimately charge the cars up. Do you think that's sort of a proper way of thinking about sort of secondary and tertiary effects of a mega trend like that?
No, I think that Kevin is very good at interpreting narrative, and he has developed a narrative that appeals to high-end Western speculators. The real upside in the whole electric cycle isn't vehicle electrification. That's sort of the icing on the cake. Most of your listeners probably are unaware of the fact that there's almost 1.2 billion people on Earth with no access to electricity whatsoever. Another 2 billion people suffer from energy poverty, which is to say either intermittently available or unaffordable electricity. We as a species, humankind, has done a great job in the last 30 years elevating the material living standards of the poorest of the poor. We've done a truly spectacular job, and I think that continues. It's the electrification and the improvement of electrical service to the 3 billion poorest people on Earth that will have the most dramatic impact on all phases of electricity. The increasing electrification that people like you and I will enjoy in our lives will be important. But the truth is, if you're a commodity investor, your eyes need to be on the poorest of the poor. When the bottom third or the bottom half of humanity gets more spending power, which mercifully they've been getting rapidly for 30 years, the expenditures that bring utility to their family are material expenditures. When you get more money, you buy a service, or maybe you buy some little gadget like an iPhone that makes your life simpler. There isn't much material component into the expenditures that you as a Western person, the audience that Kevin is addressing, makes. When poorer people get more money, they may go from foot-powered transportation to a bicycle, to a 50cc motorcycle, to a Toyota Hilux. They might go from a mud hut to a cinder block hut. Their roof may go from fat to steel. Their calorie count per capita in the family may go from 1,000 calories to 1,600 calories. When poorer people get more money, their purchases are materially intensive. And the real revolution in electrification will occur by our continued ability to increase the living standards of the poorest of the poor, which will generate quantum increases in demand for a variety of natural resource commodities. If you look at the bull market in commodities that began in 2000, there were two reasons for that. One had been prior underinvestment, but the other side of the equation was simply the urbanization of China. It was extremely important. And the process by which we urbanized 450 million Chinese is a process that needs to continue with 2.5 billion other people worldwide. And that's what's going to make a demand across the entire commodity spectrum, including uranium.
It's interesting because that then reminds me of another space I did with Alex Epstein.
He's fantastic.
Right. So I say, and you know where I'm going with that, his argument, which I think there is a validity to, which is this idea that you got to double down on fossil fuels because there's a real moral case that you have to make fossil fuels cheaper so that the poorest of the poor, using your terminology, can actually thrive. Otherwise, if you keep on having elevated oil prices in order to push an ESG agenda, well, that actually causes literal deaths.
Well, I think that's a proven fact. I don't want to make poor people's choices for them. To the extent that poor people live in a place that's very sunny, that's off the grid, I think technology will provide, as an example, some solar answers. But the truth is, when I look at the problem, or the problems, pardon me, you know, I've spent 40 years of my life looking at resource industry activities in frontier and emerging markets. And so, unlike some of the big thinkers at the World Economic Forum, I have the disadvantage of having been to places like Malawi and Myanmar. And the consequence of that is that I see that we're going to need all kinds of power. Are we going to need solar power? Yeah. Wind? Of course. Mini hydro? That too. What also strikes me is that, as an example, the largest year of coal demand in history, despite the big thinkers' dislike for it, was 2021. Poor people want the same living standards that you enjoy, and I'm not sure whose business it is to deny them that.
please make sure you follow Rick here on Twitter. Hopefully, Rick, you'll be more active. I think the last tweet I see is from 2018, but yeah, it's a good to kind of get engaged here. Okay, so I often rant in a lot of my tweets and my content against narratives in a way that some people find overly aggressive or overly sarcastic. I'm a big fan of looking at the underlying data, but going back to what you said a little bit earlier, when you think about uranium, there's a narrative that it's incredibly dangerous to society because, to your point, people think about Fukushima, and you can't imagine necessarily a politician getting elected based on a narrative that's pro-uranium to support the industry. So you need to have some degree of narrative to improve the future data that makes uranium more appealing. I'm curious, Rick, is there any hope for some kind of change in public perception around uranium? Because it seems to me that, yes, you've got the supply and demand imbalance there from a very long-term perspective, but you could really accelerate that if you had a more rational thought process around how to think about the space.
I think it's occurring right now. I think that there is a realization around some members of the environmental community who are technologically savvy that the best source of baseload power in the world relative to carbon generation is nuclear power. And I point, in terms of the change in the narrative, particularly to Japan. Post-Fukushima, the Japanese public believed, rightly, I think, that they were misled as to the safety of those plants by the Japanese government and by the nuclear power industry in Japan. And the public perception of nuclear power in Japan was horrific, and in some ways, deservedly so. There were design flaws in those plants that, first of all, shouldn't have been design flaws, but they were also design flaws that weren't disclosed to the people who approved them. The consequence of that, of course, is that while Japan Inc., if you will, the government, the big business in Japan that understood the Japanese need for energy security, while that whole complex was quietly very much in support of nuclear power, they couldn't turn the plants back on because the voters were wholesale opposed. The most recent polls in Japan have shown a dramatic shift among the Japanese citizenry in favor of nuclear power. This has occurred for two reasons. Their power bills have quadrupled and quintupled as a consequence of substituting seaborne liquefied natural gas for nuclear power, at the same time that the realization has occurred to the population that the Kyoto carbon protocols, which are extremely popular among the Japanese public, require the readoption in Japan of nuclear power. And so you have a circumstance where the popular polls in Japan have gone from 20% in favor of nuclear power to over 60% in favor of nuclear power over 10 years. The consequence of that is that the popularly elected prime minister of Japan had the courage to say yesterday that the country needs to return all in to nuclear power, because now he has the political support to pull that off.
I recall with Mark Nelson, who I had on Space also, it's funny, I'm remembering all these prior conversations, in talking about nuclear industry, he made it a point that there is no lobbyist group when it comes to nuclear in the U.S. I don't know if that's true or not, but that struck me as an interesting dynamic.
We'll be back after a quick break.
Foodies unite with How You Dish. It's social media with a secret sauce. Food, the world's first network for food enthusiasts. How You Dish connects foodies across the world. Share kitchen tips and recipe hacks. Discover hidden gem food joints and street food. Find foodies like you. Connect, chat, and organize meetups. How You Dish makes it simple to connect through food anywhere in the world. So, how do you dish? Download How You Dish on the Apple App Store now.
No, the industry really has two lobbying groups, or if you define the nuclear power industry being, as it is in the United States, really utility-centric, there's a fairly powerful lobbying group, but it's a behind-the-scenes lobbying group. It's a lobbying group that exists to influence the senior bureaucrats and sort of operates in the bowels of Congress, doing things like establishing regulatory regimes, establishing insurance protocols, doing things that are critically important that the public doesn't give a damn about. There is a rather powerful nuclear lobby in the United States. There is no effective public relations mechanism for the nuclear power industry in the United States. But these are capital-intensive businesses. These are businesses, these utilities, that generate literally billions of dollars of free cash flow. And they are politically extremely sophisticated. So to say that the nuclear power industry in the United States, at least as represented by the utilities, don't have lobbying expertise is naive.
You put your thumb right on the disparity. The underlying demand for new mine supply of U308 is less than total utility demand. Total utility demand adds back re-enrichment, enrichment, and special work units. The numbers that I get also come from the World Nuclear Association and the International Energy Agency. The thing you said at the beginning of the question is to me particularly interesting, and the mea culpa is that I have tried really since 1999 to get a handle on the mechanisms of the uranium market, how much real inventory there was, what the structure, the underlying structure of term contracts in the market was, what real demand was, and how you segregate demand by source, which is to say special work units as an example, SWU or re-enrichment. And in the process, in the period 1988, 1999, 2000, I reached out to every source I could, which is to say the brokers, the miners, the utilities, the trade groups, the traders, all that kind of stuff. And what I came back with was an understanding that the market was extremely opaque. And part of that opacity had to do with the fact that disparate players in the market wanted an information shortage. The trading community, as an example, wanted an information shortage so that they could pay attention and make some money on disparities in the market. But the other thing is that nobody actually knew many of the questions that I was prepared to ask. When I was talking to very, very, very big players in the nuclear power industry, people like Korean Electric Power, people like Tokyo Electric Power, what I came away with was there wasn't a consensus because there wasn't a consensus to be had. So some of it, unfortunately, is a circumstance where you're going to have to pay attention to bigger, less precise data than you would prefer. It's something that I struggled with for 10 years before I decided that I had to be content with the fact that if I was off on the supply side by 10% and if I was off on the demand side by 10%, but I was right about the fully loaded cost of production, and I was right about the amount of uranium, which is to say the effect of the cost of a pound of uranium relative to the output of electricity, that if I was right in a very big sense, I could be wrong in several other factors and it wouldn't really affect the outcome. I'm sorry for the inelegant nature of that response. I think the problem is that rate of change is pretty hard to calculate given the opacity of the underlying variable. I grew up in the oil market, and it's probably of all the markets, the one that I know the best in most aspects of it. I will say that in the long term, 5 years plus, I'm very, very bullish. Very, very bullish. I'm bullish because even today at these very high oil prices, the industry in terms of new project investments and sustaining capital investments is underfunding exploration and production capital expenditures by about $1 billion a day, which is to say deferred expenditures exceed $350 billion a year. When you aren't doing the new project investments and you aren't doing the sustaining capital investments, what happens in a declining business is that your ability to meet supply declines. And these addresses in capital shortfall can't be made up in a week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks, depending on price. They take years and years and years to do. In the nearer term, I suggest that there might be a couple problems, two problems at least, with regards to the energy industry. The first would be, were there a cessation in hostilities between Russia and the Ukraine, nervousness about the impending reduction in the availability of hydrocarbons from Russia would recede, and buying, structural buying that was in effect insurance or hedge buying related to that would disappear. The second, as you described, was a recession. There is zero doubt in my mind that the oil industry will suffer for some period of time
from supply issues as a consequence really of decades of underinvestment. By the way, that underinvestment continuing today. So I have no problem with the thesis that supply is challenged. If a recession or a depression, a synchronized recession or depression, reduce demand simultaneously, then the upside pressure on prices would reduce. When I look at the oil and gas industry as an investment proposition, what I see is a bunch of companies that developed some fairly good habits financially recently because they went through a very tough time. And I see an industry where on a discounted net present value basis, the enterprise value of many of the entities using, you know, sort of an 8% discount rate is suggesting that the market is discounting $70 U.S. oil and $4 U.S. gas in the face of prices that are higher than those. So while I believe in the near term there could be continued downside pressure in commodity prices, I think for investors that have, as I do, a three-year time frame, a five-year time frame, that the net present value of what you're buying today is pretty attractive relative to those prices. And I certainly know, looking forward in the oil and gas business, when you have a circumstance where you are underinvesting $1 billion a day, $365 billion a year, that you will have structural supply issues. Now, this is a really complex question. What the investment community today is asking the oil industry to do is decapitalize. They're concerned about the Bidens and the Trudeaus and the, you know, Greta Thunbergs of the world. And they're concerned by the suggestions from Biden and Gore and others that 10 years from now, oil assets will be stranded assets, which is to say that the political class is actively trying to raise the cost of capital for the oil and gas industry, which is, of course, a challenge. They're concerned, too, because of the bad investment decisions that the oil industry made in the last decade, which is to say investing two or three times free cash flow in production increases. And what that means is that about 80% of the public issuers in North America in the oil and gas space are underinvesting in sustaining capital in favor of returning capital to shareholders, either via buybacks or dividends or both. And I think that investors in the oil and gas space need to look to names that are profitable enough, that have enough legacy assets, but importantly are investing enough of their cash flow that they can at least maintain production while also affecting returns to shareholders. And that's a trickier game. I don't think you can buy the sector. I think you need to be selective. But I think by being selective, you, if you have a longer term time frame, are looking at an extremely attractive industry. I love the copper business. The challenges to the thesis, I guess, are twofold. One, as you point out, resource nationalism, which is to say that the greed of the political classes and the greed of the voters is unbounded. And the tendency for voters to kill the goose that laid the golden egg is unbounded too. And unfortunately, these are capital intensive businesses. You know, if you put $5 or $6 billion into a copper mine, it's stranded. It's a wonderful target for voters to steal. And we're seeing that in Chile. We're seeing a country that has easily the highest living standards in Latin America. And those living standards are really a consequence of decent political decisions that were made, but more importantly, a fairly small country that produces 30% of the world copper. The legislature in Chile is literally trying to kill the goose that laid the golden egg. Those are, in fact, challenges. But you have correctly put your hands on a lot of the industry, a lot of the problems within the industry. The predominant problem I see in the industry, or the predominant opportunity, depending on your point of view, is the fact that while copper supplies are adequate today, at today's copper price, you know, $4 US a pound or $3.75 a pound is plenty for legacy assets. There's any number of mines in the world that are making $1 million a day. But it isn't the incentive price required to bring on new copper. And with copper, what you need to understand is that the majority of the copper that's produced around the world today is produced by mines that were discovered many, many, many years ago, decades ago, and put in production decades ago. If you look at Bingham Canyon in the United States, the biggest copper mine in the United States, damn thing's 150 years old. Chuquicamata in Chile, 115 years old. Escondida, 45 years old. Grasberg, 55 years old. I mean, these things are older than me. and their ability to continue to produce copper in the fashion that they have in the past. Well, I guess it's best exemplified by the fact that 20 years ago, the average mine grade for copper worldwide was 1.1%. Now the average mine grade worldwide is 0.5%. We are approaching a supply cliff in copper. And it's difficult to address that supply cliff for reasons that we talked about earlier in this discussion, which is to say it's a capital-intensive, time-intensive business. One would think that as soon as the market price for copper went to the incentive price to bring new copper production on, that the market would fulfill its sort of opportunity. But it takes 5 years or 10 years or 15 years to address decades of underinvestment. So if you can stand the volatility in the copper market, by the way, I love volatility, and if you have a horizon that extends beyond the next long weekend, you know, over 3 or 4 or 5 years. And if too, you can factor in the sort of unquantifiable risk around the probability of and the severity of a recession or depression, I can do all those things, by the way. I handle uncertainty fairly well. Then I think the copper business is a fantastic business to be in. I mean, demand for copper is only going to increase, and it's only going to increase for a fairly long period of time. And supply is, you know, it's facing a cliff. That will depend on what legislatures do. How much of the free cash flow after a $5 billion expenditure will I be allowed to keep? And how much will be stolen by humankind? And I don't know. I mean, I really don't know the answer to that. I'm struggling with that myself. We're looking at two different opportunities in Chile. And it's easy to understand the technical risk. It's easy to understand the capital risk within, you know, tolerable variances given inflation and supply chain. What's uncertain is how much of the free cash flow will be stolen by the state. So it's becoming increasingly difficult to make investment decisions. There was 3 decades in Chile where, to the extent that you followed their environmental code, to the extent that you followed their commercial code, to the extent that you engaged in real and vigorous community engagement, that you could build a mine and you could get paid for it. And that's increasingly not the case. Let's do them backwards. The nosedive in the reserve may be, I doubt it because it's politically inspired, it may be a smart thing. I mean, if you buy all this oil during periods of time when the oil is $20 a barrel or $30 a barrel, and you lose it when oil's $100 a barrel or $110 a barrel, it might be, you know, the first time in a decade that the political class got something right, understood that markets work. I doubt that somehow. Certainly, what it means is that our inventories, our ability to manage supply crises in the future, are constrained. With regards to the broader picture, it's difficult for me to understand how in the next 5 years we make up for 3 decades of systemic underinvestment in the oil and gas business. The Saudis were able in the early part of the decade of the 70s to ramp their production capabilities from 7.5 million barrels to 12 million barrels. But that trick is sort of done. I'm not trying to say that there aren't more things out there for the Saudis to discover, but they got to go discover them. I don't see very much spare capacity in any of the UAE, Kuwait, or Saudi. I see a fair bit of low-hanging fruit in terms of productive capacity adds, but ironically, that is in societies that have chronically underinvested. I'm talking about places like Venezuela, places like Russia, places like Iran. And I don't know if you can count on those places to be able to ramp up supply quickly enough to matter. The other place, of course, that can ramp up supply, but only in the very near term, is the United States and Canada. And I suspect that if the voters give the politicians the political will to allow things like the Keystone Pipeline, that we could again surprise the world in the near term with some production increases. But I don't think even what we are capable of doing can address the supply shortages that we'll see in the oil and gas business absent a synchronized global recession or depression. I love the question. It's way above my pay grade.
Thought experiment. I hadn't thought of that myself, Jeff, but it's an interesting thought experiment.
I do risk-adjusted net present value. You know, understanding the psychology of world leaders or what the voters let them get away with is my track record is unblemished by success.
There you go. So everybody that's here, again, make sure you follow Rick Rule. Rick, first time you and I are speaking and first time I think that you've touched Twitter in a couple of years, but certainly appreciate you joining and educating the audience here, and everybody enjoy the rest of your day. Thank you, Rick. Appreciate it.
To be perfectly honest, it's the first time I've ever done Twitter. Some people in my staff have done it in the past. So thank you. Thank you for bringing me into this decade.
All right. Very good. Thank you, everybody.
The content in this program is for informational purposes only. You should not construe any information or other material as investment, financial, tax, or other advice. The views expressed by the participants are solely their own. A participant may have taken or recommended any investment position discussed, but may close such position or alter its recommendation at any time without notice. Nothing contained in this program constitutes a solicitation, recommendation, endorsement, or offer to buy or sell any securities or other financial instruments in any jurisdiction. Please consult your own investment or financial advisor for advice related to all investment decisions. Don't forget to follow at LeadLag Report on X, Instagram, Threads, and YouTube, and check out the LeadLag Report at www.leadlagreport.com. Use promo code PODCAST30 for 2 weeks free and 30% off to get access to award-winning research and anticipate stock market crashes, corrections, and bear markets.